With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore, and absolutely thrilled to be talking with Dr. Jill Tarter, who is the Chair Emeritus for SETI, the SETI Institute and SETI Research. And Dr. Tarter, welcome to MSO. Thank you for taking the time this afternoon.
Oh, you're very welcome.
When I was in high school, and we're in the same generation, young women had three options at the high schools I went to, and they were nursing and teaching and secretarial work. And you busted right through that. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit, my being a former math teacher, and we have a lot of students who come to this website. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience in high school and how you got into the field of astronomy and what your passion, how you developed your passion?
Well, I actually started, my first degree was in engineering, and I had decided to be an engineer when I was 8 years old.
Okay.
I spent all my time hunting and fishing and camping with my father, and at some point, clearly my mother had a discussion with my dad and said that I needed to start learning how to do girl things, and my dad, you know, had this conversation with me, and I was just furious. I couldn't understand why I had to choose one or the other, why I couldn't just do all of that. And, you know, I turned on the tears, because even as an 8-year-old little girl, you know that's how you get that.
Yep.
And so after we talked for a while, he said, well, yeah, I guess if you're willing to work hard enough, you can do whatever you want and do it all. And so I said, darn, I'm going to be an engineer. I didn't really know what an engineer did, but I knew that my dad had lots of male friends who are engineers. So I did. I made that decision, and a couple of years later, my dad died. And I just was stubborn, and I said, I told my dad I was going to do this, and so I will. And I ignored all the advice from my high school counselors that said, why are you taking calculus? You're just going to grow up and have babies. And I went to engineering school, and I did it. And then when I got finished, and this is a long pull, so it's not a fair comment today, but when I finally finished, I said, you know, I've gotten really good problem-solving skills from this coursework, but if engineers are as boring as my professors, I want to find something else to do.
I love it.
I stayed around at Cornell and just took courses in various subjects. And I took a course in star formation from Ed Salpeter, fantastic professor. And I thought, these are really interesting problems. This is what I want to do. And so I switched to astronomy.
I think that's...
Went to graduate school.
That's so inspiring. And I think, you know, to have that that interest nurtured and supported by family and so on is something that we have to continue today, especially given the current climate. And it sounds a little familiar. I'm sorry if I'm off base here, but it sounds a little familiar, like the character in the book Contact. Did Dr. Sagan use you as a model in that?
Well, you know, Carl wrote a book about a woman who does what I do.
Okay.
And he was a colleague, and
How did you
But actually, the female character is actually based on Carl. He was talking about himself there.
Ah, okay, all right. Well, a little ego, I suppose. You have to have that at your level. When you were in school and so on. Especially, I want to go back a little bit before college, or even in your graduate courses and so on. Is there one person that particularly either challenged you or inspired you and got the best out of you? In other words, you knew you were good at problem solving skills, but you got to show it. You got to demonstrate it.
It was Professor Salpeter's wife, Mika Salpeter, who was, in fact, a scientist and professor at Cornell, and she was a very inspirational role model. Salpeter was indeed my first husband's graduate advisor, and so we would often go to their home for parties. He was, and Mika just was So, I mean, she seemed to be able to do everything effortlessly and was very well regarded in her professional field, and she was very socially graceful and adept. And so I thought, well, there's proof that you can do this.
Yes, ma'am. Oh, I love it. Did your interest, were you first, when you got into astronomy, was it necessarily radio astronomy, or was it optical, or how did, what were your studies like at that point?
Well, since I'd done an engineering degree, which is pretty practical, I decided I would do a theorist. I would study astronomy as a theorist. So it was trying to figure out how stars formed and how they evolved and how galaxies and clusters of galaxies lost gas. And so it was really a very theoretical approach. And it wasn't until much later when I got involved in SETI that I took up radio astronomy and learned how to be an observer.
Where did SETI come into this with you?
It came into it because my first year at graduate school, I learned how to program a PDP-8/S. Now, this is the first desktop computer that we'd ever had, and it did take two people to lift it onto a desk, but indeed, once it was there, you could program it, and I was supported as a research assistant to program it to run a piece of equipment at Leuschner Observatory. And so there was no language for the machine. You actually had to program it in octal, setting all the ones and zeros for the 11 instructions.
Yikes.
Computer could do. And I learned that, and years later, it was given to a professor of X-ray astronomy, Stu Boyer, who was at Berkeley and had a clever idea for how to piggyback, as he called it, we would now call it how to observe commensally, but how to piggyback on the radio telescope that UC Berkeley had at Hat Creek. And so that while astronomers were using the telescope to take data on the motions of hydrogen gas in the galaxy and other problems of interest, we could make a copy of that data and analyze it looking for artificial engineered signals. This was Boyer's idea.
Mm-hmm.
But he had no money, and so he went scrounging, and somebody gave him this old piece that was by then obsolete. And Stu said, what do I do with this? And somebody pointed down the hall to my office and said, go talk to Jill. She programmed that thing. And so he came to my office with the Cyclops report that NASA had just put out, NASA and Stanford. And he recruited me to work on SETI because of that computer. And he gave me the Cyclops report as a recruiting document. And I read that thing cover to cover, all in one, day and a half. And I just was so fascinated by this question that humans have been asking themselves forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was impressed that I was in the right place at the right time with a good set of skills of engineering, and then I knew how the universe worked, or some of how the universe worked. And so I just got hooked and said, I'm in, and I've stayed that way.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I think... You know, it's just astounding to me that all these things fall into place, and that if I can ask you this, because I always tell kids, man, if you can do something you love, you've got it made, and do that as a career. But it sounds like you have so many, I don't want to say so many, but you have passions that you've been able to pursue. And SETI, did SETI sort of take over because you're still involved with it, you're still teaching, and you're still, very active. So did that sort of become all-encompassing, or did you still stay in the engineering part?
No. I started doing SETI, and I never stopped. And my skill set at the time helped me to understand how to build signal detectors and how to supervise the younger engineers who were actually making the equipment. And so I just got involved with another aspect of it, which was trying to legitimize the field, right? Trying to get NASA funding for this work. And so we had to spend a lot of time writing all kinds of proposals and reports that indicated that this was, in fact, not some crazy fringe idea. It was a legitimate scientific exploration whose time had come. And eventually, we became a NASA project. And then, after a, after a year on the telescope, Senator Bryan from Nevada terminated the funding for NASA's SETI project. And we had to start all over again and raise funds privately to keep it going.
I remember, I think it was William Proxmire, who had something called the Golden Fleece Award. And I remember watching on, I don't know, the NBC News or something or other. But he skewered SETI back then, and I can't remember what decade it was in. So how do you keep that afloat? How do you get, I mean, I know you get the word out. Well, obviously, your videos are amazing. But how does SETI keep that afloat? Because it is so vital, it is important, and it's still ongoing, and you have a tremendous accumulation of scientists there.
Well, back when we started, we didn't know whether there were any other planets beyond our solar system.
Right.
And so one of the things that we did was to start holding workshops about how you might detect planets around some other stars. And so we got that whole ball rolling. And as you know, it's been extremely successful. We now know that there are more planets than stars in the galaxy, and that every star has at least one planet. And the other thing that we didn't know back then when we started was the range of conditions that would allow life to flourish. We were pretty narrow-minded, and we just thought about things that would be clement for humans, right? And what's happened in the interim is the discovery of extremophiles.
Right.
Organisms that live in all kinds of, you know, boiling battery acid, frozen in ice, miles beneath the surface of the Earth, down in the around the black smokers at the bottom of the ocean. All of these new pieces of knowledge that would be involved with and support actions to try and study them, they have all made the universe over the decades of my career at least appear to be more bio-friendly than we ever knew at the start. And it doesn't mean that it is, but it at least appears to be. And so now, after extremophiles and exoplanets, it's not at all a crazy question to ask. Not only are these to ask whether these worlds are habitable, but to ask whether they are indeed inhabited, and to go looking for life. And once you're looking for life, it's a really simple step to say, well, wonder if any of that life is intelligent.
We're talking with Dr. Jill Tarter, who is the co-founder of the SETI Institute out in California. And, you know, you talk about extremophiles, and when I teach an introductory astronomy course to teachers, and I always talk about phlegmballs and snotites as extremophiles. So
yep.
I just wonder, you know, I got to meet Dr. Drake, Dr. Frank Drake, back in the 90s, who opened up Project Beta, I believe it was, out in Harvard.
Horowitz's project.
And Dr. Horowitz, I got to meet him, and I got to meet Lewis Friedman and Bruce Murray. I did not get to meet you, and I did not get to meet Dr. Sagan, but it was an incredible thing. And I wonder, going back, to, if I may, we dealt with the Drake equation in my Algebra 2 class many, many times. And it's an organizer, for those who don't know, of the back then, before any planets had been discovered, of how many technical civilizations there might be elsewhere. And it's this great multiplier type thing. And I wonder now, Dr. Tarter, you just mentioned all the planets that have been discovered, capital N, the number of possible technological civilizations out there. Has that changed for you in terms of optimism?
Well, first of all, the Drake equation is exactly what you said it is. It's a lovely way to organize our ignorance. but you can't calculate anything with it
mm-hmm.
because there's such uncertainty in those terms.
Right.
Well, as I said earlier, over the years, the universe has, that as what we understand about the universe has made it appear to be more bio-friendly
mm-hmm.
than we had ever in thought. So in that sense, it's optimistic. And it makes makes absolute scientific, logical sense to see whether any of these potentially habitable worlds are inhabited.
Well, Dr. Horowitz said Dr. Horowitz said that the probability of technical civilizations in our galaxy is close to one, and he said in the universe it's definitely one. So I keep looking, and can I ask you a little bit about the one thing that's intrigued me over the years is reading about the wow signal, and there's always every 10 years there's another paper or another article that comes out about the wow signal. What's your opinion on that?
Well, if I had been running the project, you would never have heard about the wow signal.
Okay.
Because it was never verified.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's seen once and never again. We don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So as we have set up our observing protocols over the years, we have relied heavily on co-observing from two different observatory sites simultaneously. So if you find something that's transient and you never see it again, if you saw it from these two different sites with the correct change in drift rate according to where the observatories are, then you have confidence that that really was something.
Mm-hmm.
But lacking any kind of verification of that original signal, it was a strong signal. We see them all the time in our observing, but they're not corroborated by the second site. So I would not have said anything about that signal. And it's really important that I think, as we do these observations, as we make use of time on telescopes that we've built or applied for time on national facilities, that we do so in a way that allows us to... Sorry, I have to interrupt.
Of course. No worries.
Another phone call that's coming in, and
no.
I need to...
Yep, no problem. Do you want me to hold? Yep.
No, that's fine. I just...
Okay.
And my daughter, I'll call her back.
Anyway,
so we worry a lot about verification and
mm-hmm.
validation.
Mm-hmm.
And we try and plan observing strategies so that if we tell you that we found something, we can show you the data and have a strong argument that it is indeed an extraterrestrial signal
mm-hmm.
and not...
That said, what about the, is it called Oumuamua, that passed through
Oumuamua,
a couple
yeah.
of years ago? Your opinion on that?
Oh, it's an extremely unusually shaped asteroid from outside of the solar system that passed through the solar system. And we now understand that we should be expecting to find many of these in the future as we get the opportunity to observe the transient sky with something like the LSST, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope that's coming online in the next year, we hope. And that, once the first observation was made, telescopes all around the world
mm-hmm.
actually looked at it and verified that it was what it was, and we looked at it with our radio telescopes, remembering the zoo with Rama.
Yes, exactly.
Clark story.
Yep.
We looked at it, breakthrough listen, looked at it. We didn't find any evidence of technological transmitters. But we now know that there's this class of objects, and we will be, as we build new telescopes with increasing capability, we will be finding more of them.
It's fantastic. I mean, looking at the night sky and realizing that we're looking at the past is just so incredible. And then to understand, when you look through a telescope and see that little jewel, little tiny Jupiter in there of a Christmas bulb, and realize where it is, it's all amazing. And what you do is just go beyond that in so many different directions. It just blows me away. And I want to ask you about, I guess, finally, I had a kid in class many years ago now, who did not believe, because he watched something on Fox television, that we had landed on the moon back in the 60s, the late 60s and early 70s. And I asked him, I said, if Alan Shepard could come down from Dover, New Hampshire and talk to you, what would you say? And he said, well, I think that Alan Shepard was brainwashed. And I asked Dr. Shostak on email, what do I do? How do I get across to this kid? And you know what he said? You don't. Now we seem to have a large portion of our population in the United States who are like this kid. And I wonder, as you talk with young people, as you promote the work of SETI and so on, what is your message to people about science? Because to me, it's just, I don't understand people who reject the scientific method. I just don't get that.
Yeah. Well, you remind them that without science, their world would be very, very much different, and they wouldn't like it. if you deny science, then you shouldn't be taking any pharmaceuticals. Right? You get sick, don't buy. You don't deserve to get medication that was developed by scientific research. That's right. With these people, often you don't. Because they've been raised in a limited intellectual climate. Mm-hmm. Only things that are based understanding are things that they are allowed to consume.
Wow.
And so when you grow up with such cultural and intellectual, brainwashing is probably a good term, then it's very hard for many of these people to ever think critically.
Well, as a teacher, it's very frustrating. It's incredibly frustrating and disturbing at this point. Dr. Tartar, what's up for next for you now? Will you still be doing any of the videos online? I know you're involved with the Allen Telescope Array. What's next for Dr. Tartar?
More of the same from the sidelines, since I'm formally retired. I still participate in weekly meetings on the telescope and observing strategies. I write articles, and I talk wherever I'm invited to do so, because I think that SETI has this fantastic opportunity to change people's point of view, their perspective. When you talk to individuals or you talk to groups about SETI, it is it really challenges their probably day-to-day thought patterns. And what it does is it holds up a mirror to everybody in the audience, and in that mirror we see ourselves, and we get to recognize that all of us are the same when compared to something, someone that evolved on a distant planet. And it trivializes the differences among humans that we are finding so difficult to sometimes to manage. And it's really important to do that, to try and encourage people to have a more cosmic perspective, because the challenges that we face do not respect national boundaries. And we're going to have to find solutions that work for the planet, that work for a person and all the life on the planet. And so having this more cosmic perspective encourages that global cooperation, I think. And so Caleb Scharf, who's the chairman of the astrobiology department at Columbia University, has a lovely phrase. And he says, on a finite world, a cosmic perspective is a necessity, not a luxury.
I love it.
And so I enjoy the opportunity to try and encourage people to have that sort of outlook.
Well, I saw in one of your talks that you have a slide of Pale Blue Dot, and I always used to read it. Every class I taught, I teach to teachers, I always use that little essay at the end of every single class, no matter what I'm teaching. And I think that when you look at Earth from just outside the solar system, just turning around, you realize how insignificant this little place is. And your views and your optimism and your work has contributed so much that I just hope more people become aware of it and take with. There's a lot of philosophy in astronomy, isn't there?
Oh yes, there is, and some of it gets us in trouble because we've gotten a particular viewpoint on something, and we assume that the next thing is going to be just the same. When before we knew about planets around other stars, we would make planetary systems in computing models, right? And it was interesting because every single model always came out with small rocky planets on the inside, gas giants on the outside, pretty near circular orbits.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we began finding that there, it's amazing how different the architectures of systems can be and still work. So we were just feeding in our biases and not realizing the biased input that we were using to make these computer models. And so I think that the more we can open our eyes and have a willingness to allow something to be different than we find it here, I think the better off we'll be, because its internal biases are really difficult.
Oh, well, yeah, and we're seeing that across the country. Finally, my last thing is if you look at what you've done, what you're doing, and what you will do, and I think that it's just incredible the awareness that that SETI and astronomy has given the layperson like myself of what's out there and where we are in the universe. Is there something that is most gratifying to you in terms of your work that you really feel good about yourself, or about the company you keep, if you will, and what you've learned over the years and the astonishing stuff that's out there?
Well, what's gratifying is the fact that I've been part of being able to do that. So you said you advise how you advise young students, and I do a similar thing. I tell people they really like to do, and then work hard and do whatever it takes to get to be better at it than anybody else. And then when you have those tools, you can go looking around for interesting challenges and problems that those tools can help solve. And that way, you know, you'll never work.
You know, you said something, and I promised you this is it. Work hard, Dr. Tarter. I mean, that's a phrase that is thrown about, but I know what you're saying. I'm sure that you have put countless hours in on some projects, and maybe there were even some problems that you thought might have been insoluble, but you kept working at them. And I think that's an important thing to get across to young people, is it not? That you got to keep flailing away at it.
Yes, you do. And again, it was something that you like to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it doesn't feel like flailing.
Yes, ma'am. Dr. Tarter, this has been the most incredible half hour I've ever spent doing this, and I can't thank you enough, and I wish you nothing but the best. Keep the stuff coming, and I'm going to keep looking at it, and I'll keep presenting it to my teachers, and be well.
Great. You too. Stay safe, and when you've got this up, please let us know.
Yes, ma'am. I will. I'll email you the link, and I'll send it right along. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Okay. You too.
Thank you, Dr. Tarter. That is Dr. Jill Tarter, who is the co-founder of SETI Institute out in California. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and she is the chair emeritus for SETI Research. And she was also sort of the model. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Jodie Foster's character really was about Carl Sagan. So there you go. That makes sense. Read that book a long time ago, a book called Contact. Anyway, that's enough for this. Thank you so much. This is MSONewsports.com.